I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, family members of both the suspects in the Cleveland kidnappings and the Boston Marathon bombings have denounced them, and that made us wonder about the family members of other people who've been accused of horrible acts. So we reached out to two of them, the daughter of a serial killer and the brother of the Unabomber, will both be with us in just a few minutes. First, though, we want to talk more about another difficult story that's captured the nation's attention for a variety of reasons. It's a difficult subject, an aspect of it might not be appropriate for everybody, so we'd like to tell you that right now, because we're going to talk about Dr. Kermit Gosnell. He is the abortion provider from Philadelphia who was sentenced on Wednesday to life in prison without the possibility of parole for murdering three babies during later-term abortions and for committing other crimes at his clinic that resulted in serious injuries to other patients. He ran the clinic for some 30 years, mostly serving minorities, immigrants, and other low-income people. We wanted to talk more about this, what this could mean for the abortion debate and other issues more broadly relating to health care in neighborhoods like the ones where he practiced. So we've called upon two journalists who've been covering this issue. Kelly Goff is a political correspondent for TheRoot.com. She's with us from our bureau in New York. Julie Rovner is a health policy correspondent for NPR, and she's with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome back to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me here.
Now, Julie, this case has been covered closely in Philadelphia from the beginning, but it first kind of, I would say, burst onto the national scene because there are a number of conservative activists who oppose abortion rights who felt that the issue was not getting enough national attention. So I want to talk a little bit later about the impact on public opinion and how activists on both sides are addressing this issue. But the first thing I wanted to know is, now that this case has concluded, are there regulators taking a look at this? Are there some policy implications that are seem to be flowing out of this story?
Well, there are some, but, you know, I think a lot of it, there was a lot of feeling that this was really a failure, not of law, but a failure, as you say, of regulation, that there were laws on the books. Obviously, there were laws on the books because he was convicted. So now we have, you know, two committees in Congress, in the House, who are asking state, both public health officials and attorneys general, if there's anything that they need or what are they doing to prevent things like this from happening. But this really seemed to be more of a breakdown in regulation as opposed to a breakdown in law. So it's hard to know what the policy implication, you know, from that would be, which is not to say that there are not going to be efforts to use this case to push the policy goals of those on both sides of the abortion debate.
We're going to talk about that in a minute. But Kelly, you wrote a piece for the Post titled How Kermit Gosnell Can Save the Abortion Rights Movement. Talk a little bit more about that, because a lot of people were talking about the fact that this was such a horrific environment, you know, unsanitary conditions. Mm-hmm. It goes on and on and on, that many people are saying, well, this is kind of a clear, from a public relations standpoint, this would clearly redound to the benefit of people who oppose abortion rights, because
right.
They would say that this is exactly the kind of thing that needs to be stopped.
Well, you know, not to sound melodramatic, but I will for a moment and sort of say that, you know, the saying that you have to hit rock bottom before you can sort of start climbing back up. And I kind of consider this case that for the pro-choice movement, because I know there were people who were surprised that I wrote this piece, because I've long been identified as someone who is a staunch supporter of reproductive rights, and I am. But what I kind of think has happened, Michelle, over the years is there has been such a defensive position on the part of the pro-choice movement, and some of it well justified, right, that you have states who are trying to make it difficult for women to have legal and easy access to contraception and as well as abortion rights. So there's been sort of such a defensive focus on fighting and digging your heels in and protecting reproductive rights at all costs that I think that a lot of people on the pro-choice movement has sort of missed the evolution that has happened in this country. And what I mean by that is a majority of Americans support Roe v. Wade and don't want to see it overturned, but an overwhelming majority of Americans oppose late-term abortions. And yet, even though those numbers have been pretty steady in terms of the number of Americans who oppose late-term abortions, particularly in the third trimester, even some in the second, there has been really an unwillingness of the pro-choice movement to sort of talk about where people who feel that way fit into their movement. And I think that that's been problematic. I think it's allowed the other side to sort of gain some traction and sort of convince those people that if you're reasonable and you're someone who doesn't support late-term abortions, there's not a place for you in the pro-choice movement. And I think that that's sort of hurt the image of the pro-choice movement in public policy. And right now, a majority of Americans actually identify as pro-life, according to Gallup, even though what's interesting is a majority of Americans believe that most of the country is pro-choice, which I found that to be a fascinating contradiction that Gallup just released this week.
Julie, talk more about this, if you would, about where you see public opinion and the activists going on this issue? What are the how are the two sides framing up? One of the things I found interesting about your reporting is you reported that one of the big questions is whether Dr. Gosnell is an exception or is he an outlier or not?
Well, and that, of course, is the big question. You know, those on the anti-abortion movement would like to say that, you know, there is a Gosnell in every state and every city, that they just haven't been uncovered yet, that there are many, many like him. And, of course, those in the abortion rights community say that, you know, no, obviously there are very few of these people like this, and that the big problem is that the more you restrict abortion rights, the more you will then drive women to people like this. If you make it harder and harder and harder to get safe abortion care, you're going to drive women to unsafe abortion care. But if I could go back for a second to this question about public opinion, this has been the case all along. If you go back, I've been studying this for 25 years, that the public is basically of two minds. They believe that abortion is bad, but it should probably also be legal. And again, they believe that it's more acceptable earlier in pregnancy. So the later in pregnancy you get, the less the public approves of it. The problem becomes, and this is the case in almost every state, is that abortion is in fact illegal after viability, except in what we call the very hard cases in which it is a threat to the life and or health of the woman, or in cases where the fetus is not viable. And then the question becomes, what do you do if you try to ban all abortions late and then the woman, you know, has some terrible problem with the pregnancy? And, you know, most of the of abortions that are late are not the kinds of things that Dr. Gosnell was doing. Most of them are done in hospitals with women who have terrible problems. Something's gone drastically wrong with the pregnancy. Do you want to then ban those and have, you know, women die? That becomes the question.
Hold on a second, Kelly. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the murder conviction of abortion Dr. Kermit Gosnell in Philadelphia. We're talking about what the national implications might be with that. Our guests are NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner, also with us, TheRoot.com political correspondent Kelly Goff. Both of them have been reporting on this. Kelly?
I just wanted to say that I agree with what she said, and so do most Americans, right? And that's what I think is so fascinating, is Planned Parenthood released data earlier this year that showed that when push comes to shove, most Americans really don't appreciate being pushed into the black-white labels of pro-choice or pro-life, because most people are smart enough to know and empathetic enough to know that real life falls somewhere in the gray area.
Well, speaking of this issue, speaking of black and white in a different context, Kelly, there's something I wanted to ask you about. Recent figures from the Centers for Disease Control, this is 2009, show that African American women have the highest abortion rate among ethnic groups. And yet, according to opinion research by the Public Religion Research Institute, a slim majority of black women that they surveyed say that having an abortion is wrong and is morally wrong. And I am interested in your take on, are there racial aspects of this story that come to light for you that you think we need to talk about?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, we know that minorities and people who are low income are less likely to have health insurance. So they're less likely to have easy access to things like contraception and OBGYN care and prenatal care. And also, we know that in our community, all of the statistics show that we tend to identify as more religious, more church going. And there is a direct correlation between people who identify that way and access to adequate sexual education. And I mean, I've had this conversation with ministers for pieces that I've written, and there is just sort of a disconnect in our community where people think that it's better to just go to church and say, here's the sex talk, don't have it, don't do it until you're married. And then we also know the marriage rates in our community. So there are a lot of layers here, Michelle, that have to do with both race and class. But I just have to say really quickly that one of the things I wrote in my piece for The Post is when Julie was talking about viability, that's really what I was getting at in terms of the fact that I think the pro-choice movement has to do some serious soul searching and some reevaluating. Because one thing they don't really like to talk about is the issue of viability and science, and particularly how science is evolving. And this story, I think, is going to force them to find a way to talk about viability, because they've got to, or else they're going to continue to lose supporters who are sort of people like me, who are common sense supporters of reproductive rights, but also acknowledge, I don't have a medical degree. I don't know when a fetus is viable. And I know that a fetus can live is more viable today, earlier, than it was 20 years ago. And if that's the case, then we got to talk about that and how that affects where the reproductive rights movement is heading.
But Julie, on the whole question of the bottom feeder question, is that something that the pro-choice movement is also addressing? I mean, the conservatives, as you said, are making the people who oppose expansive abortion rights have made the case that this gentleman is not an outlier, that this is more common than people believe. Have people on the other side made a convincing case around this question either? I mean, their argument has been that, you know, of course there are bottom feeders because the debate has become so hysterical that only people who are either ideologues, strongly committed ideologically, or who are bottom feeders would stay in a field where it's so difficult. Have they addressed this question for themselves on that side of the debate?
Well, they're trying to. You know, it's hard to say whether how well they're doing it. You'd have to sort of ask the public how well they're doing it. But certainly they're making the argument. I mean, it's one of these things is it's like putting the frog in water and boiling it. I mean, what's happening to abortion rights and abortion access over the last really 10 years? What's happened is that you've had a lot of very Republican state houses and very conservative state houses in a lot of states in the last really decade who've cut back significantly. We've had hundreds and hundreds of laws passed cutting back on abortion rights and abortion access. And so what's happened is that you've really had in many states made it very difficult for women to access abortion services. And what the abortion rights side is saying is that that has led inevitably to women having no choice but to go and find people like, you know, Kermit Gosnell.
What do you think is the next story you'll write about this, Julie? What's the next thing you're interested in as a person who's covered this issue for such a long time?
I'm actually interested in where the next generation of people who are going to provide abortion is coming from. You've got a lot of medical students who are now, you know, there's such a stigma to providing abortion that, you know, what happens to, as I say, the women, not so much the women who want the elective abortions, you know, oops, I got pregnant, but the women who have medical problems and actually need abortion care and might not be able to get it because there's nobody who's going to be trained to provide it.
Julie Rovner is health policy correspondent for NPR with us in Washington, D.C. Kelly Goff is political correspondent for TheRoot.com with us from New York. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, we will speak with writer and scholar Mark Anthony Neal about his new book, Looking for Leroy. It's about how Black men on stage, screen, and on the radio shape and reshape how we think about Black men in everyday life. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we want to touch on one of the stories that's both fascinated and appalled this country recently. It's the story of the three women in Cleveland who were apparently held captive for a decade by a local man named Ariel Castro. He's been charged with kidnapping and rape, and initially his two brothers were arrested also, but later released after police found no evidence that they knew. They've also denounced their brother in the strongest terms, and so has his daughter, Angie Gregg. Here she is.
My father's actions are not a reflection of everyone in the family. They're definitely not a reflection of myself or my children. We don't have Munster in our blood.
That got us thinking about what family members must go through when one of their own, someone they've loved or at least lived with, is found to have committed a crime. And not just any crime, but one that most of their friends and neighbors find shocking and horrifying. With us now are two people who've lived through that. David Kaczynski's brother, Ted, became known as the Unabomber. He's now serving a life sentence for mail bombs that killed three people and injured more than 20 others. Also with us is Melissa Moore. Her father, Keith Hunter Jesperson, was convicted of killing eight women. He's currently serving life in prison, and Melissa Moore is co-author of the book Shattered Silence, The Untold Story of a Serial Killer's Daughter. And they're both with us now. Thank you both so much for speaking with us and talking about something like this.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
So this isn't the only story recently where family members have been brought in. We're thinking about the Charniev brothers who were suspected in the Boston Marathon bombing, and their family members and some felt were very divided about this. And so, Melissa, I wanted to ask you, when you heard family members come forward, obviously people in the media like myself were seeking them out, but did you have any particular reaction to that?
Actually, I was really proud of them for their courage to speak out. A lot of the people that have reached out to me since writing my book, Shattered Silence, they're underground. They're hiding. They've changed their last name. They don't want to be associated with the criminal or the crime, and they go in complete hiding. So to have the courage to speak right now, I mean, I'm astonished and I'm proud, to be honest, of their courage.
Well, why do you think it's important to speak out? Why do you think that has been important to you?
For me, I've kept it a secret for over 15 years before I started coming out and sharing my story and writing about it. It harbors the shame and it harbors the guilt. And to pretend that I don't have the past I have. That wasn't being honest. So it was just a huge burden. So I'm thankful that they're not going to follow my footsteps.
Just briefly, Melissa, before I turn to David, can I ask you, you were 15 when you found out that your father had been charged by the police for the crimes for which he was later convicted and is now serving a sentence. Your parents were already divorced by that time. But do you remember what went through your mind when you first heard about this? I understand that your mother gathered the kids together and told you.
Right. My mother gathered the three of us. I'm the oldest of the kids, and she said that my father was in jail. And my brother had the courage to ask for what, because we could tell by the look on her face that she didn't want to talk about it any further. And she said for murder, and that was it. There was no more conversation after that. We just all just scattered and went to our own rooms. And I was laying on my bed just wondering and pondering what kind of murder. I mean, he's 6'6", 300 pounds. Did he get in a fight? And then I had a memory from my childhood when I was six. There was a black stray cat my brother had found, and my dad grabbed the cat and strangled the cat in front of us three kids, all screaming, of course, and horrified. So my memory went back to that cat incident, and then I realized that my dad's definitely capable of killing a person.
I'm sorry. You know, David, speaking of the burden of dilemma and the burden of knowledge, you face the moral dilemma of whether to turn your brother in. I mean, you played a critical role in solving that the case. And do you mind talking a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, there was a great deal of soul searching. And I'd be the first to say that without my wife Linda's insight, I probably never would have suspected my brother. I think when you're close to someone, you love someone. I thought my brother was incapable of violence. But later on, when Linda urged me to read the Unabomber's Manifesto, we began to grapple with the realization that the voice of in the manifesto was sounded like my brother's voice. And then we faced this awful dilemma, feeling morally impelled to stop the violence, but not wanting to unleash violence against my brother. And hiding from it really wasn't an option.
I was going to ask, did you ever consider not turning him in or just trying to just persuade him to stop?
You know, we were really struggling with if he was responsible for these crimes. In some sense, I felt this was a manifestation of his mental illness. I don't think there was any kind of agreement or promise we could have got from him that would have satisfied us. And, you know, I think we really felt that we had to stop him from hurting anyone else.
Was the hardest thing making that first phone call, or was it after you had decided and, say, telling your mother? What was the hardest thing about the whole experience?
Well, certainly making the decision was so difficult, and that was kind of unfolded over a period of time. As we read Ted's letters and Linda and I discussed, and we wrestled with the moral dilemma that we were facing and with the urgency to act. At that time, I didn't actually tell my mother what was going on. She was elderly, had worried about Ted for years. Believe me, this was way beyond her worst nightmare about what could be wrong with Ted. And so when the FBI asked me to approach my mother and tell her not only what was going on, but the role that I had played in alerting the authorities, I really didn't know if Mom could forgive me for this kind of betrayal. We all knew Ted was vulnerable because of his mental illness, that we thought he needed protection. We didn't know that society needed to be protected against my brother. So when I sat Mom down and kind of began telling the story and some connections we had made, she was just looking at me with this kind of look of horror and disbelief on her face, and I truly feared that I might lose her love when I told her what I'd done. And then when I did finally tell her that I'd gone to the FBI and they were investigating Ted to see if he might be the Unabomber, Mom was really extraordinary. She got up out of her chair and, without saying a word, came and put a kiss on my cheek. And she said, "You know, David, I know that you love your brother. I know you wouldn't have done this unless you truly felt that you had to." And then later on, as things unfolded and years before she passed away, she really said, "David, you really saved your brother. You saved him from himself. You saved him from the death penalty. You saved him from the harm he was doing to others."
Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I certainly do. It certainly was not good for Ted, let alone society, for him to be unleashing this kind of violence. And I don't know if he is at peace. I hope he is. He doesn't communicate with me, but I'm at peace with the decision that we made to stop him.
Our guests are David Kaczynski. He's the brother of Ted Kaczynski, who's known as the Unabomber, and Melissa Moore, who's the daughter of convicted serial killer Keith Hunter Jesperson. We're talking about how families cope when one of their own is involved or is accused of a notorious crime. Melissa, I wanted to ask about, you know, you were telling us that you know other people have reached out to you who have the same experience that you have, and you say a lot of them are underground. Why do you think that is? I mean, do people shun you, blame you? What is it that would cause people to want to withdraw like that?
Most of the reasons why they tell me is that they're afraid of how people will respond to them. And they're afraid that they'll lose their jobs or what will happen to their new life that they've built for themselves. Some feel ashamed. They feel guilt for being related. She mentioned Monster in My Blood. I mean, you don't want anybody to make a prejudgment based on your family about what kind of character you have.
Well, what about you? Did you have that experience? You know, you were 15. That's a point in your life when friends are really important. Did your friends treat you differently after it became known that this was your father, even though you hadn't been living with him for quite some time?
Right. My friends... parents actually wanted them to stay away from me. They didn't want them to eat lunch with me. I remember the very next day after the news had broke about my father, their parents had seen it on the news, and they told their children not to hang out with me. And so when I went to school that very next day, which I'm glad I did go to school because I wanted some sense of normalcy after that shocking news. I just want to feel like something's normal. But I could hear my last name being whispered in the hallway, and I heard, you know, murder, and I heard just under people's breath, and then go with my lunch tray to my group, and then they say, I'm sorry, you know, my mom doesn't want us to be around you. And I mean, then I really started to feel like it's my fault, that somehow I'm guilty by association, that somehow I'm the reason why they don't want to be around me. Something's wrong with me. And so after that, I changed schools. But that experience really gave me the precursor of what I thought anybody else in my future would think of me. And so that's why I kept it a secret for so long until my daughter finally started to ask me questions when I'm a young mother. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started to speak out.
How do you understand that? I don't understand that, but how do you understand why they would react that way?
Well, I know I'm not the only person that has experienced a similar situation like that. I've heard from a therapist across in Europe reach out to me when a professor was found out to be a serial murderer, and he had two young girls, and the young girl, when she went to school, certain parents had asked for her to be removed from the classroom. So I know I'm not the only one that had a similar situation to that. I think it's just lack of knowledge. What surprises me the most, though, now that I look back to that time period, is that the school counselors must have heard it on the news, but yet none of the school counselors, you know, reached out to me. So that surprises me, too, when I look back.
Hmm. David, do you have thoughts about this whole guilt by association question? I'm wondering if you dealt with that. Also, too, it's such an interesting question because you, for many people, you were a hero. Tell me, what's your thought about this?
Yeah, I think there is a stigma. It doesn't surprise me in a way that people in similar situations just want to stay out of the line of fire. They want to stay out of the limelight. And I think one thing that is different about for our family is that having turned Ted in a sense, inoculated us against some of the stigma. I don't think it's all of it, though. I mean, certainly I hear whispers at times, and over the years I've made many friends in the victims' community. Even one of Ted's victims has become my best friend. And when people are involved in these kind of tragedies, whether on the offender's side as a family member or on the victim's side, there's some sense in out there in the world that people shy away a little bit as if it were contagious, or probably more likely because they really don't know what to say, and so they end up kind of avoiding you.
There was a substantial reward. You turned it down. As I recall, you asked that the reward money be given to the victim's families. Do I have that right?
Well, actually, we did, and the government said no, they couldn't do that. So we had to set up a private foundation and distribute money to victims that way. Doing that with the reward money was not a difficult decision. The last thing I would ever want to think is that I turned in my brother for money, and to be able to do something, however inadequate, to help the victims was very meaningful to us.
You mentioned earlier that you tried to reach out to or connect with your brother through the years. Has he ever reached back?
No, he hasn't. When Mom was alive, we both wrote to him with some frequency, and I still send him a letter two or three times a year. It's kind of hard sometimes to know what to say anymore. I do think about him every day. I don't think of him as a monster. I think of him as a person I love who did things that I despise, and he did them because he was confused and disturbed, and I just wish he had gotten treatment for his problems.
Melissa, what about you? Do you have any ongoing connection to your father?
I chose to cut off my connection with my dad. He used to write me letters, and I remember feeling so nervous when I go to the mailbox and see the white envelope from the correctional facility. As I started to come forward with my story and started to speak, then the letters that started to come in the mail would be controlling and angry and accusatory, and that's when I decided I wanted to stop contact with them. I wish I would have made that choice earlier, though, to be frank and to be honest. I still felt that as his daughter, I had this duty, I guess, to stay in contact with them every holiday. I would think about him and think that I needed to send him a Christmas card. I just felt a responsibility as his daughter. But then as I started to take care of myself and realize that this is an abnormal situation and I don't have to stay in contact, that's when I cut ties, and it was the best thing that I did for myself.
Mm. Well, thank you again for speaking with us, and thank you both for your candor and openness of heart about something that has to be difficult, even now. I wanted to ask each of you, just your circumstances are unique, but yet they're not, I mean, a lot of people have experienced, unfortunately, family members doing things of which they are very ashamed, things that have harmed other people. And I just wondered if somebody was listening to our conversation, if you had some advice for this. I don't know. Maybe, Melissa, I'll start with you, and then, David, I'll ask you to have the final thought.
Yeah, I feel like just speaking, for me, that's been the number one thing that's been helpful. And I hope that others that are out there, that they will be inspired by David and hopefully by my story, to know that it is possible in these horrific circumstances to find a ray of hope, a ray of light, and there truly are still good things to come after a situation or a past like this.
David?
So much of what Melissa just said resonates with me. I think that clearly we didn't choose what happened in our families, what our family members did. We can choose how we respond to it, and I think we can respond in a constructive way by educating people, by reaching out to others. It breaks my heart that Melissa was never approached by a counselor at school. I think there's so many children traumatized in our world, in our society, who don't get the help that they deserve and need. And I strongly believe that going through a tragedy like this can make one more sensitive and more committed to trying to create a better and kinder world.
David Kaczynski is the executive director of a Buddhist monastery in Woodstock, New York. He was kind enough to join us from member station WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. Melissa Moore is the author of Shattered Silence, The Untold Story of a Serial Killer's Daughter. She was kind enough to join us from a studio in Dallas, Texas. I thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to spend the last few minutes today talking about some new ideas about race and ethnicity in this country. In a few minutes, we'll hear about a new book that examines how pop culture figures like Jay-Z and Denzel Washington play with and possibly change our ideas about what it means to be a black man in America. First, though, we want to meet somebody who has plans to do a deep dive into these issues from a new perch at a venerable institution. Professor Tricia Rose first made a name for herself for her groundbreaking scholarly works about hip-hop. Now she's been named director of the Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity in America at Brown University. We wanted to know more about her vision for the center, so she's with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations.
Well, thank you, Michelle, and really happy to be here.
So first of all, tell us about what a center like this is supposed to do.
Well, this center is intended to help scholars and students work together to create new ideas and examine existing conditions on issues of race and ethnicity in America. So it's really a research center. You know, most colleges are driven by teaching and then individual scholarship. But this is sort of a space, a kind of hub that we hope will bring scholars together with students and with visitors and with the public to really think together about some critical issues in American society.
Do you hope to influence how we talk about issues where race comes to the fore? I mean, I'm thinking just in the last year or so, a case like, you know, the Trayvon Martin shooting in Florida. Are you hoping to influence conversations like that are in the news, that are on everybody's mind, or historical ones, or what?
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I would be thrilled if we could have that level of influence, and that is one of my hopeful goals. I mean, look, we have a multiracial democracy with Native Americans, various Asian Americans, various Latino Americans, African Americans, and other people of African descent, and we make up this huge mosaic along with whites and other ethnic groups, and we don't have much of a public sophisticated conversation about what it means, using public issues like Trayvon Martin or even the Charles Ramsey example that just happened, where the sort of why did he go viral, right? What was going on? Was it just appreciation? Was it a little bit of mockery? What is the nature of how that plays out? A place where you have different types of scholars who are working on all these issues in an accessible way can be a very powerful source of sort of public knowledge and transformation. So yes, that would be ideal.
How do these ideas get from the campus into the popular conversation? For example, there's just been a whole generation of scholarship around issues related to Africans in America that most people don't know anything about. I mean, so I'm wondering, you know, how you plan to try to get those conversations from the campus into mainstream conversations.
Well, that's my favorite question of all time, because it's what I ultimately do this for. I mean, of course, I do scholarship because it's interesting to me. But if it's not either accessible in form or made accessible in form and content, then what is the point, right? Ideas are meant to be shared. Ideas are meant to help people make sense of the world they're living in. So for me, the sort of retreat into sort of private scholarly conversations is something I am deeply personally unhappy about. And I think we have a technological moment that we should take deep advantage of, right? I mean, there's no reason why we can't become visit you and your terrific show, which I think is dedicated to complicated social issues in everyday language, use the media better, but also use the internet, right? Lots of technology now makes it much easier for scholars with this kind of commitment to do research together and to participate in the public conversation. So that is a commitment that we have. And because we don't have disciplines to worry about, we're not just psychologists, we're not just historians, you know, we have to learn to speak to each other in an easier way and share that knowledge with a broader public.
You know, to that end, I'm interested in your work in the last couple of minutes that we have left. You've often been called a hip-hop scholar. That in part refers to your well-received books like The Hip-Hop Wars, What We Talk About When We Talk About Hip-Hop and Why It Matters. There's also Black Noise, Rap Music and Black Culture in Contemporary America. I'm always interested in when people use the term hip-hop scholar. Do they mean that you bring a scholarly approach to hip hop, or are they referring to something else? Are they referring to a different way of doing scholarship?
Well, some people are saying the latter, but that would not be me. I mean, I study African American culture, gender, expressive, you know, culture as in the arts, and the social structural issues that people of African descent in the U.S. face. That's what I study. And hip-hop is a very productive place to think about what's happened over the last 40 years, creatively, technologically, aesthetically, in terms of the arts of it, and also the social issues, incarceration, sexism, communities falling apart for a variety of structural reasons. So for me, it's an opportunity to seriously engage with people of African descent. And so the part of my book title, you know, The Hip-Hop Wars, what we talk about when we talk about hip-hop and why it matters, it's that connection that is extremely important to me. Why does it matter? What's at stake? And I'm hoping this center can do that for Latinos, for African-Americans, Native Americans, and Asian-Americans, and anybody else who wants to really answer these questions seriously.
Before we let you go, do you have a sense of what your first project will be or how you want to?
What's your first
100 days?
Well, my first 100 days is, you know, getting in the saddle. But there are two things that I want to do pretty immediately. One is really compare immigration and incarceration around the question of criminalizing Black and brown youth, not just boys, but also girls. And this language of criminalization as a way to think about a whole generation and the profit imperatives behind it. So that's one thing I'm hoping to do. The other thing I want to tackle is hot, difficult topics, which I'm calling right now the Third Rail series. What are the issues that we really need to address? This colorblindness, the idea that discrimination is over, affirmative action, you know, these really tough issues that if we can't figure out how to talk about, well, you know what, we may not be able to get very far. So I wanted to have a serious conversation that is accessible about these critical issues and hopefully impact the conversation at the broader level.
Tricia Rose is a professor at Brown University. Later this summer, she's taking up the post as director of the University Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity in America. And she was kind enough to join us from the studios on that campus. Professor Rose, we hope we'll speak again. Thank you for speaking with us.
I would love to. Thanks, Michelle.
We'd like to continue our conversation about evolving ideas about what it means to be Black in America. Looking for Leroy, Illegible Black Masculinities is a new book that focuses on how African-American men in entertainment, television, movies, hip-hop in particular, influence the way Americans view Black men in their everyday lives. The author is someone we turn to often for his interesting insights about culture. His name is Mark Anthony Neal. He's a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke, and he's with us now. And because we want to be able to speak frankly, given some of the lyrics we want to talk about, this is probably as good a time as any to say that our conversation might have some language that might not be suitable for everybody. And with that being said, Professor Neal, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
Now, so the Leroy in the title comes from the character Leroy in the 80s movie and television show Fame. I just want to play a short clip. Here it is.
What do you mean I can't do that? I can do whatever I want. Maybe that's why I'm leaving school, because I'm sick and tired of being told what I can and cannot do. Sick and tired of it!
What about this character inspired you?
There are a few things. You know, Leroy as a kind of, shout out to an everyday Black man from 30 years ago. I mean, we all knew 12, 15, 16 Leroys, you know, when we were growing up. But Leroy in this case, this is me at 15 and 16 years old, you know, watching Fame on television as a high school student in the Bronx. And just being fascinated by this character, the cornrows, the way his body moved, the way he dressed, the way that he dealt with the Black world, the way he dealt with the white world, particularly in the art school that he went to. And I was just fascinated by this character. But as a 15 and 16 year old, I also thought this was a character that was gay. And we hadn't seen an out gay character on television in the early 1980s, and nothing about the show even suggested that he was an out gay character. But there was just some way that I read the character that struck me as interesting. And when the actor who portrayed Leroy, Gene Anthony Ray, passed in 2003, I remember looking for just some confirmation that Gene Anthony Ray was gay, as if, you know, the two things could be connected together. And when there was no confirmation of that, at least, you know, to somehow, you know, calm my 16-year-old mind going back in the past, you know, it just raised a question for me about what if we are just so tied to these kind of readings of Black men and boys, Black masculinity, that you either have to be hyper-masculine or you have to be queer.
You talk about the images that Black men have taken on in entertainment throughout time, and you also note that the range hasn't changed. Like, for example, in hip hop, you talk about these various roles that people seem to be assigned to. And again, this is where I have to give the language warning. This might not be something everybody wants to hear. But the roles you talk about are player, pimp, hustler, thug, and nigger. What do you make of that? I mean, is that a bandwidth? What is that?
You know, there are ways in which when we think about black men and boys that when we see them in certain kind of roles, we don't even think twice about it. The example I always use is if we see a black man with a basketball, we don't even have to process that. We've seen that so many times in our lives, we know exactly what that means. If we were to see a black man with a violin, that gives us reason to pause, right? We have all of these questions that are now attached. You know, how did he get the violin? Does he know how to play the violin? How can he afford the violin? I mean, we can go on and on. And I think hip hop becomes a very interesting space in this conversation because it's a space that is, for all intents and purposes, monetized the image of black masculinity, right? And made several of these figures incredibly wealthy. If we're talking about the Jay-Z's and the Snoop Dogs and the Will Smiths and a whole range of other folks. But it's also a space that limits our understanding of the range of possibilities of what black masculinity can look like.
Well, you know, it's not exactly new news that a lot of people feel that minorities in general, black people in particular, black men, especially in particular, if I can say that, are limited by certain stereotypes and images that people have of them. In your book, you prefer the term legible and illegible. What do you mean by that?
I use the terms legibility and illegibility to talk about these images that are readable to us. So whether or not they're stereotypical or not, there are certain images of black men that when we see them, we know exactly what that is. We can read it. We can define it. But then there are these other images of black men that we don't quite know what to do with. So really the labor of the book, the labor of the writing, the scholarship, is to take these very legible images of black masculinity, say someone like Jay-Z, and read him as a cosmopolitan. Or to take illegible images of black masculinity, Luther Vandross being a good example of this, and reading him in a different kind of context.
I feel comfortable saying a lot of people feel that, you know, that entertainment just generally serves to reinforce opinions people already have. You say that actually some of these entertainment figures change these images. I'm going to play just a short clip from Jay-Z. I'll just play a clip from the song that maybe people think of as kind of a classic hip-hop song, Girls, Girls, Girls.
Now that's young chicks, new it is, project and motto. That means I fly rough early, plus I know Tabo. That means I'm new school, pop pills and stay in beef. But I never have a problem with my first class seat. I love
girls, 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 girls.
So what is it about Jay-Z that you feel kind of challenges the stereotype?
You look at a Jay-Z or Snoop Dogg, and any of these kind of, you know, mainstream figures, and there's an incredible amount of pressure for them to produce the kind of work that is recognizable to mainstream audiences, that allows them to sell records, to make movies, and all those wonderful things. And so we have this song that's about his desire for women, but then when you watch the video, and the video itself kind of plays in these same kind of ideas for much of it until the last 30 seconds. And you see the camera pan back, and what you see exposed literally is a constructed cardboard set. You know, the house where all these women are supposed to be is literally just a piece of cardboard. All of the women who are supposed to be his women are just revealed to be simply actresses. And he walks off the set and shakes their hands and thanks them for working with him on the music video. He takes off his shirt as if he was taking off his uniform and then walks out a door that says Jay-Z closed set. And for me, it's a simple little gesture that says, you know, this is the business side of this. This is Jay-Z the brand, but Sean Carter is someone separate and distinct. And so much of what I do throughout the book is to find these little gestures towards another idea of who black men are. So that when I talk about Stringer Bell, for instance, from The Wire, and of course he is, you know, this notorious figure within this, you know, drug ring in Baltimore, but yet he's also an intellectual. You know, so he's reading these interesting kind of books. You know, in one of the episodes, you see on his bookshelf, you know, the great Adam Smith book about capitalism. You know, this is someone who runs meetings, you know, with these little street corner hoods, you know, using Robert's Rules of Order.
Well, here's a clip of what you're talking about. And again, this is where I have to give the language warning.
Chair recognized Slim Charles. Chair, our people got to stand somewhere, don't it? I mean, all the product in the world don't mean nothing if you constantly get ass whooped for standing on another fool's corner, man.
Yo, get it straight. Your territory ain't gonna mean shit if your product is weak. Go ahead and ask them if it's trying to sell them four tempos when you got niggas riding around in Japanese and German cars in America all day.
Yeah, but how we gonna stand?
Yo, she ain't recognize your ass, man.
he's in the drug game not as an end but as a means to an end, right? Because he can't get into Wharton and he can't get into the into Tuck, you know, so the drug game becomes his MBA program.
Is your book ultimately optimistic or pessimistic? I'm asking because, again, in just about every instance you cite, you could argue that these men have expanded the possibilities of how black men have been seen. And in a lot of ways, you could argue they've just reinforced it.
I'm very optimistic about what these images mean. And the best way I can describe it is how these images have impacted myself. You know, the second chapter of the book is devoted to the career arc of Avery Brooks, great stage actor, television actor, fabulous voice, you know, in terms of singing. But most folks got to know Avery Brooks in the 1980s watching Spencer for Hire and A Man Called Hawk, in which he played this enforcer, this big black man with a bald head and a big black gun who would show up and people would run and scatter.
Well, here's a clip of Avery Brooks as Hawk.
Chopin, a lyrical technician, as a friend once called him.
That's a perfect description.
Do you know me?
No.
I'm Hawk.
When we see A Man Called a Hawk, what we see is a character who's revealed to be a classical pianist, you know, who sits down and has, you know, erudite conversations with his mentor about Langston Hughes and great, you know, religious, black religious theorists and all these kinds of folks. And as a college student trying to wonder myself back in the late 1980s about what it would be to live a life of the mind, it was watching Avery Brooks on Hawk that convinced me that I could grow up in a place like the South Bronx and see myself as a thinker, even as I had to kind of navigate the space that the South Bronx meant for me growing up in the late 1980s. And I'm sure there's some young person now who's watching a Jay-Z navigate this space or who's watched Stringer Bell and Idris Elba, you know, the actor who brought him to life, watching The Wire and watching how he navigated these very different worlds, that are imagining or reimagining the way that they can be in the world. So in that regard, for me, I'm always optimistic about the potential that these images can have on folks.
Mark Anthony Neal is a professor at Duke University. His latest book is Looking for Leroy, Illegible Black Masculinities, and he was kind enough to join us from the studios at Duke University. Professor Mark Anthony Neal, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.